Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daoust, Thursdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. Your host, Eric Davis. Exploring the cultures of consciousness. One of my favorite books the last year or so is a remarkable object called Burlesque Paraphernalia and Side Degree Specialties and Costumes Catalog, number 439, and it's a reprint of this completely bizarre and wonderful supply catalog for America's enormous number of fraternal orders in the early 20th and also late 19th century, and it's full of, well, you'd have to call them kind of mystical pranks, devices, costumes, gags, slightly sadistic sort of electrocuted grass and stairs that fall apart and things like that that were be used for the initiation rites of the enormous number of fraternal societies that existed in America at that time, something we don't know very much about, but which I was happy to read a great deal more about in a more recent book that just came out, Ritual America, Secret Brotherhoods and Their Influence on American Society, a wonderful, big, fat, image-packed book in the old sense, not something easily to squeeze into a e-book reader, from Farrell House. And we'll be talking to the author and Farrell House co-publisher, Adam Parfrey, today about that and some other books, including also a reissue of our very own Maja Daoust's book, The Secret Source, which he did also with Adam for Process Books, and it's a great sort of back history on The Secret and the sort of contemporary wave of hermetic and flavored new thought ideas and concepts that we find in the New Age today, which of course have an ancient tradition attached to them, as do most of the odd things we talk to on this show. So with no further ado, I'll bring on Maja. How are you doing, Maja?
I'm good, Eric. How are you doing?
I got to tell people, you know, this is a little bit goofy, I have to admit, but if people listening to the show were ever kind of curious what Maja looked like, you could do worse than getting your hands on a copy of The Secret Source and looking at this rather remarkable photograph. You're sort of in full white witch regalia.
It's a little over the top, I admit, but
well, the funny thing about it for me is that you look very serious, and when I think of you, there's always a huge mischievous grin on your face. So when I see this sort of like radiant, but very mature and focused face, I'm like, eh.
You're totally blowing my cover right now, dude.
Look, anybody listening to the show could tell you're a smiley lady.
It's true. I know. That was from a photo shoot where I was trying to channel Stevie Nicks and be super serious. So I'm glad it worked.
It's totally perfect. I think it's totally great. That's the same one that was in the LA magazine, right?
Yeah, from the same shoot. Yeah, totally.
Very good. Very good. Using those images. All right. Well, congratulations on the reissue. That just came out, right?
Totally. It came out, I think it's going to be on Amazon just in March, but I got the copies, and you can order them on Process Media's site right now.
Yeah, and it's nice. It's a good, not heavy hardback. I really like those kind of smaller hardback books. And there's a little bit more stuff in this than in the first edition?
Yeah, I added a chapter on sex magic. everybody's favorite.
I was going to say, you really can't go wrong with, like, well, I was struggling about whether or not to add this chapter on sex magic.
And will people like it? I don't know.
So, okay, well, that's great. Well, let's bring Adam on. Adam, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Well, hi, guys. Really happy to be here. Hey, Maja. Hi, Eric.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Hey, wait, are you in up there in the wilds of Washington State?
Yeah, I presume Maja would know a lot about it because she grew up around here, but it's a beautiful and somewhat isolated area up of these parts, and I'm not sure how I'd react if I grew up here like Maja, but I'm glad to be up here now.
Yeah, because you escaped the big bad city that where you'd been for quite a long time.
Yeah, if I need city, I can drive there or fly there. But then, you know, I'm just as happy as I am to get there. I'm happier to even leave for a bit to get back to home.
Well, you know, I definitely want to talk, you know, Feral House has been, you know, a figure in my life for a long time, and it's one of the more interesting publishing stories or, you know, independent publishing stories in my book over the last couple decades because, you know, it's been going for such a long time and put out some scandalous, marvelous, inspiring, disturbing material, but you know, also really kept it together. I mean, it's still going pretty strong, and you know, has led to this you know this recent batch of really interesting books. But before we talk about Ritual America, which I'm you know very intrigued by, I'm just kind of curious how you see, you know, when you think about why you started the press in the first place, and what kind of material you were interested in and what you wanted to do as a publisher and how that's kind of changed and how it's kind of maybe, you know, stayed the same as you, you know, continue to work on sort of underground culture and the, you know, the heresies of our current world.
Well, when I started the press in the 80s, what was going on was, you know, there was no internet at the time. And what have you. So books were basically the primary source people had, and magazines too, of course, newspapers, of getting their information that now is far more easily accessed online. But at that time, I was really disappointed as a reader to how difficult it was to get intriguing or interesting volumes. You really had to look hard and long to get them. They were out there, but it was really difficult to access that information. And then when you came across like Robert Anton Wilson and something like Cosmic Trigger, that seemed so important, so amazing at the time, because otherwise it was very difficult to access that information. So at that, when I started publishing, was with this guy named Ken Sweeney. We started with an imprint called Amok Press, and at that time, Amok Press, there were some guys in L.A. who were doing an Amok bookstore, and then they had a catalog they put out called the Amok Dispatch, and I helped out with that stuff, and hit the partner in Amok Press was Ken Sweezy. His brother Stuart Sweezy is involved with the store and the catalog and all that, but it seemed, you know, at that time, extremely exciting to get that information because people wouldn't just be aware of it. And I can just say,
I'm just going to interject for people to understand that Amok bookstore was so important and, like you said, exciting. I mean, you would go in there, and it was like a treasure trove of all the things you would hunt for everywhere else, but it was all in one spot. So it was like this really important portal to be able to give people access to that information.
Yeah, and I would even say that, you know, same thing. I was glad I got to go there a number of times, and I interviewed Stuart, you know, in the early 90s. And what's interesting now to look at that culture from our current internet perspective is, you know, a lot of people talk about curation now. Like, you know, the idea of being a curator is a really widespread idea in our current moment, you know, from the idea of being a curator in a gallery. Now people recognize that, you know, DJs are curators and people who do websites are curators, and everybody's kind of filtering and shaping. And what was really remarkable about that moment, both with you know, Feral House and Apocalypse Culture, and particularly the collections, the sort of, you know, journals of articles that you put out, but also those, you know, the Amok catalog, and there were other like catalogs of zines and whatever, is that it was really a really, and I think more so than at any point earlier in the counterculture, a moment when kind of collector printhead librarian types were bringing bringing that kind of energy into this like far underground of very challenging material that in a way was sort of like opened up by the punk rock spirit, even if it wasn't actually itself more, you know, particularly punk rock, but it was something about that turning everything upside down that revealed, you know, this whole wide crazy world. But because people were willing to go in and help kind of organize and filter it, like the shop, like you guys, like what a publisher did, it really created a little, you know, something that was reminds me in some ways a lot of what people are trying to do now with different kinds of media in terms of becoming portals, becoming filters, more than just putting out specific, you know, articles or books.
Well, Eric, that's a very excellent observation, and that the curatorial dynamic of it. And thanks for bringing it up, because that was where are we put into the publishing world right now with the availability of internet? You know, you can get, if you search on Google, you can get it just about anywhere and anything. But again, as you say, there's no real curatorial aspect of it, you know. So, as a publisher, it's my spot right now is like, well, you can get just about anything. Well, that's actually not true. You really can't get just about anything. You have to, there are a lot of these books, or like Ritual America, there are things that are just not available online. You can't.
Well, and looking, that's such a good point, Adam, because for people that might think, you know, they have all the conspiracy stuff available online and might think, well, why should I get your book? There are images in Ritual America that are so obscure, and that, I mean, I have never seen in all my years of perusing this material, I mean, not like just because I haven't seen it doesn't mean I'm like some kind of expert, but the curatorial feat that you've pulled off with Ritual America is really, I mean, it's something like I haven't seen for a long time. I mean, can we talk a little bit about like how did you go about collecting all this amazing stuff in there?
Well, they weren't available to me. I mean, first of all, when the beginning of that collecting material for the book, I walked into the Philosophical Research Society library, and you were librarian there. and so you accessed me all of Manly Hall's collection, and it was so incredible. I'm into that store, see this beautiful woman who helped me access all this material on Freemasonry and oddities in that fraternal world. And that was a brilliant start to this collection. But another thing is that eBay and other collector types, and you can find things in scrapbooks, for example. Like you, in the past, you weren't able to find a lot of this material because you had to go to people's personal collections, what they put in, what they collected themselves. Of, you know, snapshots, photographs, all these other things. And so that's why you haven't ever seen it before, a lot of it. And also from newspapers and magazines that are not on microfiche or digitized or anything. So you can't find them otherwise. But eBay was an amazing source for that. And also, thrift stores and searching around. Way people get things is
One of the things that comes through to me also in specifically in relationship to the internet is that if I go on the internet and I say, okay, I want to find out about Freemasonry in America, or I want to find out even about the history of Freemasonry in America, what I'll get is this weird melange of conspiracy kinds of things that are extremely ahistorical. They have very little sense of how, not just like the quote-unquote facts about what happened then and what happened then, but about thinking historically, which means that things happen at certain times because other things are happening at certain times. There's context for everything. And if you want to talk about the history of Freemasonry and other fraternal societies in America, then you're going to have to kind of talk about race, and you're going to have to talk about show business, and you're going to have to talk about, you know, agrarian politics. And I mean, there's these other things that go on that are almost entirely missed in that kind of conspiratorial world, where they're either weaving their own kind of pseudo-history, or they're trying to defend a very kind of conventional, you know, surface view of the phenomena. But what I get when I look through Ritual America, which is full of these photographs, like Maja says, that I haven't seen, that you've been able to access and collate, and I actually really like the way you use just a lot of, like, fair use citations from a lot of material, rather than, like, writing a whole book yourself. You mixed up your own writing with a lot of quotations from other sources. Some of them are obscure, some of them are other books that are out there floating around. So somebody going through this book can really learn, you know, a great deal. But it's something about the way the photographs themselves, the sense of an archive in history, if done with care, it actually, you learn a great deal more than if you just read any individual's kind of take on, you know, who Albert Pike was, or, you know, what was the relationship of, you know, the Shriners to the, you know, Masons, in terms of who was more evil, or, you know, some kind of, you know, pseudo history that way. So it's the archiveness quality of it that that makes it a value, like a useful publishing object, you know, in an age of online information.
Well, thanks for saying that, Eric. It was, yeah, that was the challenge of it, because the more we got into that subject, you saw how wide-ranging. It was all over the place. It's sort of like doing a history of fraternal orders. It was like doing a history of the country itself, and more, because you had to get more in-depth into the background of everything, because it was, you know, so-called secret societies, you know. So what information are they going to be putting out, you know? Because, you know, there's all these challenging ways of presenting this information. And so to do it both with text and images that's not generally discovered or found or accessed. For Rachel's question, you brought that up earlier, this was extremely striking to me, because I didn't think I would get onto that link. You know, of course, the Ku Klux Klan was, you know, a Protestant fraternal order with its ritualism based totally upon Masonic issues, you know, and so, you know, it's just that one, you know, order or group with like that, and then you go, no. And these magazines are Shriners, and they're talking, you know, in racist language stuff.
Hey, Adam, it sounds like you're...
you turned into a robot.
You've become a space robot. Maybe what you should do is hang up and call us right back, and hopefully the line will be a little bit better.
That was kind of amazing.
You know, it was kind of cool, you know, sort of like, oh, here comes the robotoid Adam. But, you know, I think it's, you know, for the sake of cogency. But there was some great stuff in this book. The whole thing about the goat, I'm so...
Oh, I know. The goat one was something I had found on the internet and actually sent him, and then he found, like, the references to it. It was so amazing.
Well, that's
right?
One of the things you see in this other burlesque paraphernalia book, is that they have, like, these mechanical goats. And I guess it's funny because, like, official Masonic historians will say, oh, there was never a goat as part of the rituals. That was just some kind of joke thing. But it seemed to be something that was maybe like a joke ritual that then became more integrated in these orders. So there's all this stuff about goats, and then obviously there's the whole kind of devil side of it, and it's just this weird mixture of like corny showbiz and ancient esoteric symbol, and it's just fascinating.
I think
stuff.
It's a very appropriate way to bring Pan into it in that kind of jokey humor. I think Pan would be quite pleased.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just checking in. Are you back, Adam?
Hi, I just heard Pan, one of my favorite mythological figures, absolutely.
Well, yeah, we were talking about the goat, the whole figure of the goat as part of these, and the way that sort of Pan returns as this mixture of, you know, esoteric initiatory symbol and goofy showbiz prank, you know, and it's just a remarkable. Can you just give us like a little bit of sense of like what the story is with the role of the goat in these fraternal societies?
Well, I'll just give you a sociological version of it. You can get into the more esoteric aspect of it, but the goat, I think, in a way it served in these fraternal orders at the time, around the turn of the century, like the 19th to 20th century, was the, it served as a kind of an in-joke, because the Catholics, who were against fraternal orders until they created their own, the Knights of Columbus, they accused fraternal orders of being satanic. And they always, so these, sort of like Eliphas Levi and all the other writers of esoteric lore we know of, they sort of brought it on as an in-joke. Yes, we're in love with goats. Look, here's a goat here. And we'll bring it in as an initiatory prank. We'll have the goat that the initiates will ride on and get shocked on. And then also there was a book of humor that was brought out called The Lodge Goat. It was like 500 pages or more. And it was all the jokes about goats and all that. There were a lot of postcards that were issued with women writing goats or on goats. It's like your woman that you go after, or that men would be drinking and have goats drinking with them or playing cards with them. It was an in-joke with all the fraternal orders at the time. It was kind of a slap at the Catholic invective, but it was also, you know, it was also a special in-group chatter or joke situation.
Well, and that was no small matter. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, one of the popes actually made a papal bull declaring Freemasonry satanic, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
They call them vendettas, I think.
Yeah, totally.
And that's where that common word comes from, you know. But absolutely, they're still issued against it. I mean, as recently as the 70s, I think.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things you mentioned in the book that I thought was, I think it's in the book at the very end when you're talking about the sort of state of ritual societies today, you mentioned something that I had also kind of picked up from friends or friends of friends, that, you know, what's happening now is that there's all these, these wonderful buildings, and, you know, sometimes they get sold or whatever, and the Oddfellows Hall becomes a rock concert or becomes an office building or whatever. But there are these amazing buildings all across the country, some in small cities, some in small towns, some in big cities, that are, you know, fraternal or Masonic. And some of them have these orders, but they're getting old. And it's like, what do we do with this thing? And, you know, the one time I went to a hall as an outsider, you know, it was very, it was a really weird mixture of, like, these sort of, you know, all this esoteric symbolism that I can read, but at the same time, it was clearly just like, you know, a meat and potatoes night for the senior guys and talk about war stories or whatever. I mean, it was such a weird mixture of, like, totally mainstream aging America and this kind of lingering air of something that maybe once was symbolic of some kind of spiritual or esoteric or political or philosophical real kind of worldview. But I've heard that there's like in some places, some younger people are trying to kind of come in and like restore the sort of mysterious aspect of it, you know, occultists, or people are interested in other kinds of esoteric orders with real initiation ceremonies. And that's the thing that really blows me away. There's something profoundly American, even though, of course, Masonry is all over the place, in the developed world, but there's, especially the story you tell, there's something so American about this combination of a, you know, powerful, transformative, initiatory framework with symbols and ritual gestures and esoteric language, and this, like, totally, you know, cornball America, Americana, white male privilege gone wrong, goofy clowns in little cars, and the mixture is just phenomenal.
Well, there you go. There's America for you. I think a lot of that esoterica was used as I know something you don't, and that makes me better kind of thing. It wasn't necessarily to unlock the unknown worlds in a kind of a Rosicrucian manner. You get that sense it was this networking aspect of it,
yeah.
There. But how much does it filter in the human mind if they keep saying those things and keep learning those esoteric aspects? I don't know exactly. But it is curious. They have there's a kind of a twilight language speak, you know, of that. And how much does it affect the human who utters it, whether he knows what it means or not? I have no idea about that.
Well, one thing it does is it creates this space for, like, you know, fascination, where, if you just the history of how the Masons have been represented, not how they represented themselves or used
yeah.
representations for their own, you know, work, but just how other people have seen them is itself this enormous, you know, mythology of contemporary mythology. You know, at the one end you have people thinking they're, you know, Satan worshippers, at the other end that they're, you know, the captains of industry who are manipulating all of the world economy, you know, and then, you know, and all the various sort of real sort of horrors that have come out about it. It's links to, you know, racism with the Ku Klux Klan, and then at the same time you have fraternal orders that become the site of heretical African-American Muslim, moments. But it's partly because there is this twilight language that even though there's no there or very little there, it looks a lot like there's there. And so everybody has a field day, and it almost becomes like there's real masonry, and then there's this sort of myth masonry that's almost more powerful in terms of its effects on popular culture.
Indeed. Well, it intrigued me particularly when you get into the Shriners, and there's Shriners outposts in Iraq, in Baghdad, and in Afghanistan, because in contemporary days today, Freemasonry really has not fallen off in importance with police and the military. We call it Brotherhood of the Gun. But that surprised me. It also surprised me. We're going in battle against these Muslim countries, and to be inducted into the Shriners' orders, one would have to have their hand on a Quran and speaking an oath. It's kind of bloodthirsty, and you have to look at these American soldiers from, like, Omaha, Nebraska, doing that. That's weird to me.
it's
striking.
Yeah.
Well, what it is to me is like that kind of usurpation of that form of power, right? And the whole thing with part of the Freemasonic rituals is to take the power of the other person by, it's almost like very headhunterish, where, you know, you drink the blood of the person, then you kind of take on their effects, like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom or something. And it has that kind of Aztecian quality. So to me, the Shriners in Oklahoma taking that, you know, oath on the Quran and using the Muslim symbols, it's almost like that kind of mockery where they're trying to imbue themselves with the power of their enemy a little bit.
I think that's a good way.
At one point, I don't think it was mocking them. I really thought it was an exotica that they wanted to bring.
Yeah, I think it's more like it's more like what you were saying about drawing the power by appropriation or by mimesis. In a way, it's the kind of like imaginative side of the colonialist enterprise. It's like as colonialism spreads and, you know, totally dominates the mid to the end of the 19th century, which is when you're starting to see a real rise, at least in the form that we're mostly looking at in Ritual America, then there's all these confrontations, and at that moment, to appropriate the imagery of you know, and if you look at some of the costumes they wore, it's just a tremendous, the costuming.
Yeah.
And but it's hard to say because, for, you know, among the, you know, the rich white guys dressing up like, you know, grand viziers or whatever is obviously this kind of exotic appropriation in kind of a cheesy way. But then you look at, like, the Noble Drew Ali and the sort of African-American mm-hmm. fraternal societies where they were starting to appropriate images from the Middle East, but they were doing it in a way to almost create like a parallel identity, like a mythological identity that they could use in contrast to mainstream Protestant America.
Well, Noble Drew Ali specifically, since there was some material he discovered that there were some agreements between the state of Morocco and an early, you know, the early founding fathers, he felt that he was a direct link into America, that they couldn't find, like, not that he was a slave, that he was in charge. And it was an empowering situation for Noble Drew Ali and his order.
Yeah, I love the photographs of those guys in the book, too. Those are really spectacular. Well, this is totally a lot of fun. We have more to talk about. We've got to take a break here. This is Eric Davis with Maja Dawu. We're talking with Adam Parfrey, publisher of Feral House and author of The New Ritual America, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dawu here with Eric Davis, and we're speaking with one of my favorite people, Adam Parfrey. And there's just so much to talk about with this book. But Adam, I wanted to bring up, you know, we talked a little bit about Feral House at the beginning, and you do have a reputation as publishing controversial material, I think, you know, for the good. And I've even had people approach me and said, oh, God, you know, you wrote a book with Adam Parfrey. What was it like writing with him? Like, isn't he satanic or something? And, you know, I always advocate you and Feral House as being one of the last kind of perpetrators of free press. And what I've seen and know of you is that you do actually stand up for yourself and allow people to have an avenue, but it's not at no cost to you. There have been backlashes against things that you publish, and there have been kind of, you know, people that are upset by some of the things you publish. And so I was curious with Ritual America if you've had any kind of backlash from the Masons, or if that's okay to even talk about. Like, it seems like there's a lot of secrets kind of in here, and a lot of people would maybe not publish a book like this because they'd be afraid of the Masons. Has that been an issue for you?
Well, the book has just come out. I don't think anybody's really seen it yet, so we'll see about that. But strangely, a couple things have happened, though. In advance of the publication of the book, a friend, I get maybe a former friend, I don't know, but a guy named Jay Kinney, who was editor of a magazine called Gnosis, a great magazine, by the way, and I had great respect for Jay, and he was an underground cartoonist as well, but he is climbing the ranks of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. He's 32 degrees now. I think he's trying to get onto the upper rank, 33rd degree, but that is not something he can do. He has to be appointed to that degree. But he brought out a book called Masonic Myths, and he criticized me in the book for publishing material that he thought was just horrible and not right for masonry, but it was this guy named James Shelby Downard in the first apocalypse culture book. He did a piece called King Kill 33, and that had some effect because, you know, Marilyn Manson did a song with that title, and other people thought it. I thought it was like the craziest and most amazing piece of writing I'd read up to that point about, you know, in a conspiratorial tone.
Totally.
And it opened my eyes about twilight language, about the significance of numbers and the significance of names in terms of things American, you know? And even if it was a little not entirely correct in every way, it just opens your eyes to possibilities. That's why I published it. But unfortunately, Jay Kenney made it seem that I'm a really bad guy for publishing that kind of stuff, and that.
Well, and one of the things I like about how you operate, Adam, is you publish things without an agenda. So it's always ironic to me that people would put some kind of like conspiratorial angle on you, because while some of your stuff may be sensationalistic, you just present the information and let people kind of figure it out. You're not promoting any kind of conspiratorial agenda. So I'm always shocked to hear that someone would have that kind of react, because you're just saying, like, here, look at this, right?
Yeah, look at this, look at that. Make up your own minds. It's interesting. I think it really diminishes human character to be told what to think every moment of the day, you know?
Yeah.
From whatever angle you're coming from. You know, that's what, you know, Fox News does. That's what, you know, even some leftist organizations do. But people really understand. I mean, I don't like being told what to think and what to do, but to investigate, and that's always been the rationale and reasons behind Amok Press and Feral House. And
well, that's that punk rock attitude that you still get the flavor of. I mean, what sort of can be, you know, sometimes some of the stuff you'll put out is, like, to me a little bit like red flag. Kind of sensationalist in the sense of, like, knowingly putting something out there that, like, people are going to be like, whoa, what's this? But at the same time, that's not just, like, for cheap tricks or just to get an effect. It comes out of that punk rock attitude, which isn't so much like not having an agenda, because, you know, you do want to put stuff out there that's, like, you know, pulls up the floorboards, and that kind of some of it freaks people out and some of it is very challenging to conventional ideas. I mean, there is a sense of like a kind of mission there, but it's also that it's like aggressively unwilling to kowtow to kind of whatever, you know, like sort of like appropriate release. I mean, it's really true, especially when you're talking about religion, and even though the Freemasons aren't religion exactly, there's a lot of similarities where, you know, if you're like talking about Islam today, you know, you can try to say things that people who are Muslim, or especially people who are, you know, who track people who talk about, you know, Islam, and you could try to do it in a way that's not going to completely piss them off from the get-go, in which case you're inevitably kind of compromising. Or you start saying, look, I'm not going to pay attention to that. I'm going to call it as I see it. And you put it out there, and then they just won't even pay attention to you, or they'll be pissed at you. So there's different kinds of conversations you can have. So in a way, I could kind of appreciate why somebody like Jay might be annoyed with some aspects of it. I don't agree with sort of, you know, any kind of, you know, condemning of publishing sort of materials. But in a way, that's, you know, it's partly your job is to challenge people and to continue to challenge people in that punk rock way. I mean, another thing that makes me think of this is that another great book you just put out that I'm very happy you put out is Three Issues from the Process Church, the sex issue, fear issue, and death issue, in a very handsome, you know, hardback form. And I had only seen Xeroxes of these amazing, you know, magazines from this very peculiar sect, very
really
controversial,
amazing.
hard to put your head around, challenging to everybody. I mean, even if you like, you think you're a Satanist and they talk about Lucifer and you start reading it, it's like it's challenging to those guys. I mean, it's a weird, hard to pin down, intense, multifaceted, very 70s kind of sect. But, you know, you look at these images, and it's not just about what their content is. It's the way the layout is, how they're designed, the photographs of the people in the group, the typeface, you know, all of the material that they were putting into these wonderfully designed magazines. Yeah, it's a little aggressive. You know, it's like that's like you doing your job. It's like if people are going to come across that, it's like some people are like, oh, yeah, it's so weird, that's cool. But a lot of people be like, wow, things were stranger than we thought they were. And that's great, you know.
Oh, great. I'm glad you like that. It was such an influence on me, the Process Church, and I was so lucky to run into people who were very involved with the original aspects of it, like Timothy Wiley and all that. And I'm able to put out a book with him on that whole sect called Love, Sex, Fear, Death, The Inside Story. Because I didn't know what the inside story. I was always challenged and thought, are they what the true crime hack writers say? Were they the most sinister sect in the United States? Are they do they murder all these people? Do they murder dogs? What's going on here? And that was just, I guess you can say anything about anybody. That was kind of shocking to me. And that people can put out books. I can read like one called The Ultimate Evil and other books from people I admire, like Ed Sanders, that about the Manson family, and that the Process Church is tied into that. And it amazed me that people can just overtly lie and they know better and do these books for the sake of making money, I guess. That was very striking to me in this respect, to investigating the process.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, if you take Sanders, though, I mean, I think some of these people are clearly like they're just in that kind of hack journalism where you'd link all these links together and you take advantage of ambiguity to tell these conspiratorial stories that make you seem like you have finally the secret history to the evil in America. With Sanders is a little different, where you know that chunk of the his book on the family that got removed in subsequent editions. I think he was representing something else, which is also true, but more difficult to put your finger on. Which was there's this sense, particularly in the counterculture, because the counterculture had this problem of like they were pulling up all the old restrictions. You know, there was all this hedonism, all this exploration, all this sense of, like, going farther, of challenging your programming, of recognizing the way you were programmed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's this problem, whatever, the Manson problem. It's like where, you know, it's tempting on the one hand to pathologize Manson, say, oh, yeah, he was just this crazy, horrible sociopath who exploited hippie memes and in order to do his devilry, when of course he was much more of an organic product of this very scene. And so I think that people who are really invested in a lot of those values, they don't know how to deal with these dark edges, and so they project more. You know, it's like, oh, then there has to be, you know, there has to be like occult human sacrifices going on in Los Angeles in the late 60s. You know, that explains all the bad things that happened later when the counterculture kind of fizzled and went wrong. So it's...
Yeah, I think actually in terms of Ed Sanders' own point of view, I think that the Process Church became a group of people that were emblematic of the ruin of hippie concepts and leftist ideas. And so he pointed at them out as a fall guy type of situation for it. I think, you know, I can understand why, because things were turning pretty sour when from drugs, and, you know, LSD bowed out and crystal methadrine came in, and then was all... a lot of bad stuff happening. But he pointed the Process Church as culpable for all of that. And I thought that was very strange. I expected more from Mr. Sanders.
What do you think is most important about the Process Church? Like, if you like your takeaway of like, you know, why they're worth, you know, sort of paying attention to, even though had they been so marginalized and so demonized, you know, more than Manson, more than other things. It's like that was the no-go zone. You know, don't think about those guys. What is, you know, what's sort of interesting or what's their unique contribution to this whole?
What really intrigued me in knowing more about them and the inside operation, you know, being a cult that they're following these leaders, that always troubles me. I don't like that too much on a personal level. But it was liberating for some of those people, as cults are able to do. But there's a good side and a bad side, obviously. But the thing about the Process Church, it was a matriarchal cult. It was this Robert de Grimston figure was put up as the leader, but he was just writing what his wife at the time, Marianne, was projecting. And the cult that developed into this thing called the Foundation Faith, that was all Marianne's and became much bigger at that time than the Process Church ever was. And then people from that group went to Arizona, Utah area to take care of pets. They were extremely anti-vivisectionist and pro-animal, and they started an animal group that became a TV series thing. I forget the name of the show, but it was, but that was striking. That was incredible.
I was, you know, grateful to be able to participate in some of the Process Church stuff.
Yes,
you guys
did.
And meet Timothy, who is so nice. And I mean, he went on to write books about like UFOs and dolphins. I mean, you can't get more like not satanic than Timothy.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think is the reason why it got so like taboo? Do you think it was because it was a matriarchal cult, or like, or was it just the affiliation with the Manson family that got stuck on there? What do you think it was that took it to that kind of level?
I think it was punk rock and a hippie time. It really wasn't, you know, it was, people were just didn't think it was on the right wave at that moment.
Mm.
I think they dressed up in black cloaks with hoods and stuff, and they passed out magazines that said death on the cover, passed out magazines that said fear on the cover. You know, it wasn't peace and love, you know. It wasn't tie-dye, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and it was, and like you said, I think the punk rock bit is good because one of the things that, like, I think we've talked just this whole conversation about that punk rock aesthetic, whether it reflects publishing or, you know, a spiritual cults, is a certain kind of negativity, not in the conventional sense of like no, and that's bad, but negativity in the sense of like putting the opposite up to whatever's going on. Like if you see a constraint, you just, you know, invert it, and that's just you're the aesthetic gesture, and you can totally tell that with them, where they're not so different than like the Church of Satan, which has its own interesting, you know, weirdness or whatever, but it's so just simply inverted, whereas what they're doing is like they're inverting the inversion. So it's like, yeah, there's some people who are trying to represent a satanic point of view or a Luciferian point of view, but there's also a Jehovah point of view, and there's also a Christ, and they're all like bouncing off each other in this really confusing, disturbing, and that's what makes it disturbing. Is not that there's someone, there's an advocate for Satan. Is that there's an advocate for Satan and a Christ force operating in the same sphere, and they have like dogs in black robes. So I mean, people are gonna, you know, they're going to freak out.
What's also interesting, it's kind of a Jungian context too, because they're talking about human personality and what is in a human personality, and they look into these aspects and they say, well, there's this sort of. Their definition of Satan or Lucifer is different from other interpretations of that also. But nonetheless, that's what I saw. It was just like the conflicts of an internalized human character and how it's brought out on an everyday level. It's sort of like it's the way Timothy Wiley explained it to me, being in that group was like actualizing about 60, 80, 100 years of psychological processing. So he feels like he went through a lot of inner tension and problems one would have that would one normally not go through in a particular lifetime.
Yeah, yeah. Now, that's a lot of those extreme groups seem to be, in a way, you can look at them as kind of psychological processing, environments or experiments, because there's such an intense experimental quality where nobody really knows what's going to come at the other end of that. And that's for us, that's disturbing too. Then you go, they're dark side religion. It's like, well, that's not even really the disturbing part, is that they're like, confronting in perhaps dangerous and sometimes very corrosive ways, but in other ways, liberating or at least very courageous.
The main thing is that, Eric, it's sort of like, let's bring up punk rock again. When punk rock was starting to happen, it was not allowed. It was pushed down. This is the way things are supposed to occur. This is the way you're supposed to think. And when that kind of pressure happens, and then there are all these people who feel themselves mutants from that society and that pressure to be a certain way, that's what happens, And that's what happened to me when I, in the late 70s in L.A., going to punk rock shows, The Mask and other places, sort of like, it was a liberating thing. Wow, it's not all about, like, rich people with their lines of coke and living in the hills of Hollywood, and it's not about talking a certain way that's hippie friendly, but the hippies became kind of, in a way, they became intolerant, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of funny just because there's such a connection between, the process church and the fraternal organizations and punk rock and what you're talking about, because it's really just people looking for a group where they feel like, they're not an alien. And I mean, I think that's like a lot of these fraternal organizations that you bring up in Ritual America. I mean, it's like those dudes' version of being able to go to a punk rock community. Like, they get to feel like, they are empowered and they're special and they're kind of like cutting edge and different, and it's the same with like how cults operate. And I think that's what you just said is like the appeal of all of these things to everybody.
They also were able to get away from the family structure.
Yeah, totally.
They can get out and drink with their buddies, basically, and have a good excuse to do that.
We only have a couple of minutes left, Adam, and just on this topic, you had a great explanation of what that punk rock vibe was like in the 70s and how it responded to hippiedom and created this whole space of publishing that's been a constant source of transgression and inspiration, really since that time in certain zones. But how do you feel now, like in our era now, like what is it about that vibe, or how has it changed for you? How do you keep that going in terms of your current work? We only got a minute or so, but I just wanted to let you have a last word there.
Well, thanks, Eric. When I publish things now, it has been, like it always has been, has to be things that I am specifically interested in. I never approach publishing with the way, this is going to make $1 million or anything like that. That doesn't interest me or intrigue me on a personal level. And so I've just been so lucky to be able to publish things that are interesting to me personally, that other people, or a few other at least, enough to support that type of publishing. I think it's going to be more individual as time goes on, because the old idea of publishing a mass market paperback, that's gone. The old idea of publishing a book in, when I first published anything, I could expect 5 or 10,000 people to buy the book, because it was pre-internet days and everybody's interested in the information no matter what, out of a sense of curiosity. Now it's not like that, really. So it's all really become more individualized, I think. And so I just have to keep up with that concept of whatever interests me or whatever provokes me internally. I keep at it. And since there are fewer people, perhaps, buying it, you have to go do special, very special editions. It's more individuated.
Well, Adam, I look forward to seeing what you continually to come up with. Thanks so much for being with us here on Expanding Mind.
Well, really, thanks for having me.
All right, folks.
Thanks, Adam.
From me and Maja, keep your minds open.